Hey, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. I don't know why I always play a binge drinking PSA just before I bring Blink on. No, I'm sorry.
Seriously?
No, I didn't mean that. It wasn't. It was a missing persons PSA, and I apologize. Our sister blogger, Blink, from Blink on Crime, is here to continue our discussion on the Jodi Arias trial. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening, Dana. How are you?
I am fine. I'm not sure if you got to hear the good doctor talking about...
I did. I enjoyed Dr. Bond very much.
Talking about this, and we're going to get into more Jodi Arias discussion with you. Of course, the folks can go to blinkoncrime.com to read your analysis of the case. This is quite the case. How comparable is it to the Casey Anthony trial?
Well, I think it's very comparable in a variety of ways, and I think Dr. Bond did a good job of kind of paralleling these two ladies. But one thing I'd like to point out is the media aspect is just really now kicking in for the Arias case, whereas it started that way in the Casey Anthony case, and it was that way for the duration.
That's right, yep.
So there's not really an apples-to-apples comparison in that, to my knowledge, her defense is not being paid for by the media. Or, you know, some of the definitions or changes to the current case, if they're being changed by, you know, any reporting, it's just happening now. It wasn't happening prior to the case going to court.
I had a choice between a rerun of Gilligan's Island and the 48 hours coverage of Jodi Arias here the other night. So between the skipper and Gilligan, I'd flip back and forth to watch them. And
did you see the one before this update that
yes.
that they viewed this weekend?
Yes.
Okay, so then you sensed the you noticed the contrast in what was deleted from the footage.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. What about that 48 hours interview, if you want to call it that? Is this going to help or hurt her?
Well, unfortunately, I think it does a little bit of both, yeah. But it's certainly, if it was seen, and it has been subpoenaed as evidence in this case, I expect the defense is going to show this
yeah.
at length, the first 48 hours. And within that, the problem for the prosecution is that Detective Esteban Flores repeatedly discusses his theory that Travis Alexander was shot first, which negates some of the aggravating factors that are contributory to the first, the premeditation charge and or the application to the death penalty. That's a problem.
Yep.
And that problem was not, when I call it a problem, I mean, that is new to this prosecution and the defense, because Detective Flores was on the stand and literally said, you know, this is the first I've heard of it. After the medical examiner, Dr. Horn, testified, which in itself, I would need to look this up, Dana, but I'm not understanding how a detective who's a witness in a case was allowed to watch the testimony of another witness, because in every other, you know, district court, superior court level trial I'm aware, criminal trial I'm aware of,
yep.
those folks are invoked.
Yeah. I saw that too, and why there wasn't an exclusion of him as a witness, I have no idea. It's a head scratcher, and there's more head scratchers when it comes to this. Let's talk about that pathologist and what he's saying.
Well, Dr. Horn, while I think he's a fine pathologist, I think sometimes what happens is, you know, he's no. I said in my piece before the recent update that he was no Dr. G because he's not. You'll never hear, being familiar with her personally, disclosing that, but you'll never hear her say something that she could not substantiate in her findings, ever. And unfortunately, I feel like Dr. Horn stretched his expertise in this case. When you have a decedent that's unfortunately been deceased for 5 days, and you have a bullet wound where you can no longer track the path in his right frontal lobe, you can't say he was incapacitated and nearly killed from it. You can't tell me that when he's got a, you know, an ear-to-ear gaping gash,
yeah.
and neither of those things killed him. Interestingly enough, he died from a stab wound to the heart which actually pierced the sac, the pericardial sac, I believe, but the vena cava in particular. So to say he was near death or that could have killed him when in fact it didn't kill him, that was not his finding, it does not help to substantiate the charges that are before the court, which is the problem here.
We'll bounce around a little bit on this. Blink from Blink on Crime is here, and I'll go right to that. When we asked the question and comment about the premeditation, what do you think?
What I think and what I think the prosecution can prove in this case, as they've rested, so there's not a whole lot in the way of latitude that they're going to have. What I personally believe, as my opinion as an analyst, is that she absolutely planned this crime. I believe that whatever transpired between the two while they were together may have had her rethink her initiative, and then something happened to set her off in a way that was final. And I think Dr. Bond did it. One of the things that I struggle with as an analyst myself is trying to articulate to folks the difference between a sociopath and a psychopath, and it is very important in criminal analysis. You are not going to see a psychopath until they offend. They're just that good at it. They're so detached, they're so energetic, they're so focused on emulating people that are supposed to be normal, that it's just impossible. They're not going to let you close enough that you're going to see the cracks in the cement like a sociopath. And for him to categorize Casey and Jodi Arias as both being that, their profiles are textbooked for it. But my point in saying that is it means that there was a little bit of latitude in what was going to transpire that day, in my opinion. And as I wrote, I definitely believe that it was clear to Jodi at a point when Travis was in the shower that she was incensed beyond her ability to curtail it, and also whatever it was so offensive to her, everything that she had been sitting on, if you will, in that 28-hour or 30-hour drive where she likely was only thinking about this outcome, transpired. I think she premeditated. I'm not convinced at all that the state has proven this case. Just because she rented a car, just because she, allegedly there's a gun missing from the grandparents' home that they cannot tie to this woman.
Right.
They can tie it to the crime scene, potentially through a casing, but they don't have the gun to match the ballistics to say it actually came from the gun that was from the grandparents' home.
No, in typical... typical fashion, defense lawyers are jumping up and asking for all sorts of motions to, throw things out. I agree with you when it comes to the prosecution case. It's a bit of a head-scratcher, and maybe they'll be able to fill some of those holes. Maybe they won't. I'm not sure. But what do you think the defense will be able to do, or what do you think they'll have to do now?
Well, it's that old adage, and I can remember having, it's surreal in a way, Dana, because I can remember you and I having this conversation in the Anthony trial where you said to me, do you think she'll take the stand?
Yep.
I said, absolutely, under no set of circumstances will she take the stand, and there's just no way. And she didn't, because her lawyer, Jose Baez, he already laid the predicate for her defense. There was no need at that point for her to go on. As a matter of fact, it would have whittled away what he had tried to accomplish, I believe. She wouldn't have been able to substantiate his argument or his close. In this case, I don't see her getting out of at least the jury wanting to find a felony murder case, which there's been no crime. I mean, to back up a little bit, the state has never alleged that there was a crime committed prior to the commission of Travis Alexander's murder. And I believe, again, this is what I'll call upcharging, I believe they did that because they want to force the jury to have a finding that results in the only other verdict, which is for premeditation, capital first-degree murder. In other words, they're putting two things in front of the jury. They're going, they're you know, hoping, they're swinging for the fence. They're hoping that the jury is going to be so, you know, feeling so unjust should she not be convicted of the felony murder that they're going to have a finding. When I heard the questions from the jury, I just think they have overshot this one. And when I see what's coming in terms of, you know, let's talk about what's really in effect here.
Yep.
There are outstanding motions for directed verdict and a mistrial.
Right, yep.
That's where we are, with a week, you know, hiatus
29th,
for the defense to start.
Yeah.
Who's to say that Judge Stevens is not going to rule? And I have to say, the directed verdict is rare, and I don't see her making that leap at this juncture, although she can technically split that verdict. In other words, she can order the jury to find not guilty on the premeditation if she feels strongly that that it was not proven. I don't think she's going to do that. I'm not as confident about the mistrial because I do think there has been a level of prosecutorial misconduct. It's not the first time it has happened to Juan Martinez. It's not the first time it has happened to the Maricopa County District Attorney's Office. I mentioned in one of my pieces a guy by the name of Doug Grant. It's called the Mormon Murder. Very wealthy vitamin guy. Ended up going into business with another gentleman who ended up, you know, swindling $52 million from people and killing himself in prison a couple of years later. But what happened was, in the middle of his trial, when the prosecutor was removed and Juan Martinez stepped in, what they did was they added what's called the lesser included, because they knew they were not going to get a conviction as a capital case, as premeditated murder. And what ended up happening with him is he was convicted of manslaughter. And when you have a crime scene like this one, where you have a 123-pound, you know, 5'3" woman,
right,
and you have Travis Alexander, 5'9", 190 pounds, deceased with blood loss, and the prosecution is saying, you know, this happened here, look at this blood, look at this, you know, she drug him from this location to that location, that's going to be very difficult for a jury to buy. And when you have a jury that is starting to try to put the pieces together, again, I'll compare it to the Casey Anthony case and that jury's deliberations. With Kaylee, they left, maybe it was chloroform. Maybe she died by asphyxiation with tape on her mouth. They thought that leaving it to the jury to make those decisions still pointed to the defendant. It didn't.
No.
The jury, in what I've been saying this now for almost 2 years, when you adopt the CSI effect, when you're watching Criminal Minds and you're watching these shows that get wrapped up in an hour, and it absolutely puts, you know, dots the I's, crosses the T's, it's got the finest point on these cases, that develops a thought process in folks that follow true crime.
Blink from Blink on Crime is here. I want to get into the history of Jody and the victim a little bit. But what are your thoughts on the, and I know she's been telling all sorts of stories, but the self-defense aspect of this, is that going to fly at all, or do you think they'll even use it?
I think they have to use it. I can't say that they won't do it in what is called a, you know, kind of an obtuse way.
Right.
And what I mean by that is, when presenting to the jury, they've obviously made a strategic decision whether or not Jody is going to testify. That's already done.
Yep.
So are they going to try to impart into the jury through their defense witnesses that it was impossible that it happened any other way? It's possible, because I believe they laid the predicate for that in their cross-examination, where they were talking about water in the closet and water in how it affected a storage box that was in his bedroom closet. And I think where they're going with that is they're going to say, Travis was in the shower, he lunged at her, he chased her into that closet. That's how the water got there. No, she wasn't trying to clean it up, and she fought for her life. The gun went off. He wasn't dead. He grabbed a knife. She, you know, all the things he cut, you know, she tried to grab it from him. She did. That's how she cut her hand. There's 100 ways to make this play in terms of a defense. And make no mistake, that's what prosecutors and defense attorneys do. They sit there and they decide what the case is going to look like, arguably mock jury form, to each other.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying?
Sure. Yep.
Right. They're going, okay, this is what the prosecution's like. This is what the evidence can lead to. And here are all our, you know, our examples under B. But do I think it's a defendable case? Yes. But you know mostly why I think that? Because I don't feel like the prosecution did its homework. I do not believe that they have given the defense all of their interviews and witnesses. I just put out a piece today where there are three witnesses right now, one of which has never been given to the defense but was interviewed three times, a guy by the name of Thomas Brown, who's literally finding out that in a police interview, Jody Arias named him as a possible on January 9th. How does that happen in a criminal, in a capital case? How does someone that was interviewed three times by the lead detective in a case, obviously, if he's interviewed three times but was never approached by the defense, what does that tell you?
Yeah.
He was a roommate. He was in the home when she arrived. He was there. How does it happen that that information is not turned over to the defense? And it's mistakes like that that either cause a mistrial, cause a directed verdict, or guess what? Get overturned on appeal. And the problem, and why I'm a little bit soapboxy about that, is because, number one, I think this girl is nuts, and I think she obliterated this guy.
Sure, yeah.
And she deserves to spend the rest of her life in prison. So why am I bringing up and why am I writing about, you know, the other side of the coin? Because I want to make sure she goes there, and I want to make sure she stays there, and I want to make sure that as prosecutors that we are doing the diligence so that there's not another Casey Anthony verdict because of hubris.
Yeah.
That's what happened. They were high-fiving each other down at the courthouse, thinking they had a set case. They didn't really listen to anybody that was saying, geez, I think here's where the holes are. They didn't. As a result, in my opinion, that's why she was acquitted. Because they didn't have it. Had she been convicted, based on the problems that they had with the evidence that we know now, it would have been a reversible error anyway, and she would have walked.
Yeah.
That's really not okay with me.
Blink from Blink on Crime is here. You mentioned a second ago spending the rest of her days in jail. Or is this a death penalty case?
I don't think a jury is going to put her to death. And I'll tell you why. I don't think they are able. I don't think they're going to buy the fact that the premeditation and the cruelty factors are there just based on the size of the two of them and her inability to contain him in an attack situation the way the prosecution is developing it. And they may not care. But to articulate that a little bit better, I don't believe if the questions that they asked at the end of the state's case lead me to believe they do not buy she did this on her own already. Could that change once the defense presents? Possibly, but honestly, we don't know that the defense isn't going to show up on the 29th and say, you know what? We feel that the state has not presented, it has not proven its case. We rest. I don't think that would be a good idea, but it certainly wouldn't be unheard of.
It's possible. I don't think it's going to happen either. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. Check out our webpage at blinkoncrime.com. Let's get back to the 48 Hours interview a little bit. When we watched it, both parts, and you see Jody Arias's reaction, and, you know, again, the investigator in me is listening to her talk. And I'm asking her questions at the same time, knowing very well she can't answer me. But it kind of drove me nutso because her story is about as phony as a $3 bill in most cases. Yet the defense is going to use that interview Will the prosecution be able to impeach that and say you were telling CBS a whole bunch of crapola?
Well, I think they yes, of course they can, but I think they did that in their opening where they already said she's a liar, and they already said she killed him. It was, you know, kill or be killed scenario. I think they had no choice but to, they knew this was coming. I think they had no choice to say that. And I also think if you're analyzing that, the way to present your case as a prosecutor, it could have been much more thorough. I would have taken her individual statements and presented my case chronologically to impeach them one by one. And I know why the prosecutor did not show the video, and I'll tell you, it's because, as I said before, you have Detective Flores throughout the whole thing saying, you know, yes, she was shot in the head first, and no, as a matter of fact, she had nothing to do with Travis's, you know, slash tires. There was never any evidence of that. He knew bringing it in would allow the defense to rebut that evidence or impeach that evidence, and that was already a serious problem when Detective Flores was on the stand. But I think, again, it's one of those philosophies of, do we put it out there first so we don't look like we're hiding something, which I think would have worked. She's just not a likable person.
No.
And clearly she's a sociopath. I think a layperson can look at her, and I don't think they're saying, oh, that poor shrinking Violet. I don't think she told the truth once. She doesn't have, you know, she has one member of her family in the jury, or excuse me, in the public in the seating. She has no friends speaking out on her behalf. There was a woman that testified, yes. But basically the prosecution put her on to say, you know, to basically say this is how nuts she is, because she could go commit a crime like this and then go hang out with her girlfriend, and the girlfriend never knew anything was wrong.
Yeah. No, so true. Now, you and I will be talking in 2 weeks. Where do you think we'll be at that time with this case?
I think it's possible there will be a mistrial.
Okay.
I do. Yeah. I wish the heck I didn't feel like that. But honestly, I favor that over a directed verdict. But if we're talking in 2 weeks and there isn't a mistrial, I think we're going to see the witnesses that I just talked about. We're going to see how, in an obtuse way, without saying, hey, that, you know, that second story about there being an intruder, there might be just a little bit of truth to that. I believe that's where they're going. I think they're going to say, oh, you told us that she was the stalker and she was slashing tires. Well, let me tell you who that really was. And let me tell you who was really after Travis Alexander. I think that's where they're going to go. They're just trying to create a reasonable doubt. They need one person, Dana, out of 12. They need one person that will not unanimously agree with the others. And when I read those jury questions, and I agree, you know, granted it's in the beginning of the case, it was at, you know, right before the state rested, and the defense has not put on their case, I have concerns. The way this case is charged versus the prosecution's case and what I feel that they were able to bring to bear do not match for me. So we're either going to be learning about the potential for a mistrial, which I think there's some merit to it. It just keeps adding up. The witnesses I'm talking about were withheld again from the defense.
It's, you know, I'm not making light. There's a person that was savagely murdered here, but do you think Lifetime is sending a script to Rob Lowe right now as we speak?
He gets the work, doesn't he?
He does.
When I watch Dr. Horno, it's like he even sounds like him.
Oh,
how do I not write that? Because it was freakish. And I don't think, in any stretch of the imagination, he looks like Jeff Ashton.
No.
But I've met him. First of all, Jeff Ashton is incredibly tall.
Yeah.
And slender. He's just not at all, you know.
Yeah.
It just wasn't a good fit, but I understood the reason. In this case, he looks just like Dr. Horn.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. But anyway, we'll be in touch, Blink, from blinkoncrime.com. Follow that site for all your Jodi Arias and other crime-related investigations and stories, because if that's a story out there that needs to be told, Blink will tell it. Thank you, ma'am.
Oh, thank you. Be well, Dana.
We'll talk soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Blink from Blink on Crime. And yeah, she's our sister blogger. She talks about the stories that sometimes don't get told. It'll be interesting to see what happens. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.